Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross hanging out with you, and fresh back from vacation. At least half of us is, or maybe half of me is. The other half, of course, is the inimitable Rob Ross. Rob, how's everything going in New York?
Well, it's cold here, and it makes me wish I was on vacation someplace warm like the South. But, you know, being that I haven't been on vacation now for 2 years, it just makes me gnash my teeth all the more.
Sorry about that. But yeah, we spent a week in Florida against my better judgment. But, you know, it was nice to see family and get together with them, and had a fantastic meal at a restaurant that is a legend in the Bay Area. There's a couple of them. There's a steakhouse called...
You better not say Shotsky's Deli because I'll kill you. That's so offensive.
You took the words right out of my mouth. No.
Deli, my God.
No, the first one is a place called Burns Steakhouse, and I've never been there, at least not to eat, because they don't let people like me in, you know, low class. And the other one is a restaurant called the Columbia, and it's on 7th Avenue in a place called Ybor City, a section of Tampa called Ybor City. And it is a legend. You know, Cuban food, just absolutely fantastic. It's, you know, all the standard issue stuff, chicken and yellow rice and Cuban sandwiches and all of that, black bean soup, which was fantastic. And the curiosity about this place is that its legend has been around so long that it was actually featured in an episode of the original TV show Route 66. And that's a kind of an oddity, considering the fact that Tampa, at its closest point, I think, is about 800 miles from Route 66. But it didn't stop them from filming a TV show there.
Well, I'm sure Glenn Corbett and Marty Milner had their fill.
Exactly. Well, somebody had a vacation to Tampa to take, so why not, right?
Oh, man. You're killing me, because I love Cuban food. And we had this really great Cuban restaurant here very briefly. And it's a shame that they didn't really survive. They weren't located in a great neighborhood that could have drawn enough people's interest.
Yeah.
Because it was in a very residential area, actually. It's called Lucy's. And it was just absolutely spectacular. I mean, out of this world. You know, I like to eat in moderation, but I seriously would go in there and order not one, but two Cuban sandwiches. That's how good they were. Seriously. They were just out of this world. So... now I'm mad at you.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, see, and the tough thing about it, anywhere else, even here, we actually have a pretty decent Cuban restaurant not terribly far away from here called Babalu, and they do it right. They do all of this stuff, except you can't have Cuban bread if you're not in Florida or Cuba. That's really the only place where you can get real honest-to-God Cuban bread. The closest anybody else gets is to put it on a French baguette, and that's not close enough.
Especially because of the word French.
Exactly. So either way, you know what the secret is? By the way, I found this out from a guy who was making Cuban bread down there. Everybody uses oil, some kind of like salad oil or whatever for the bread, for the mix. Don't use lard. That's why it's so awesome tasting. So
very interesting.
Yeah. But either way, back in the saddle and a little bit to talk about, I guess, as we look around the news and the news of pop culture over the last week or so. It's been kind of a crazy one. What have you seen that caught your eye?
What haven't I seen in these last couple of weeks? I mean, my God, John, you've been gone for a week. Yeah. And all things breaking loose, you know?
I know, and blissfully unaware of most of it, so.
Right now, just before we came in to start the show, I was watching The God Emperor. Do his little Hitler Youth rally down in Texas. And I got to give him credit. He is the ultimate carnival barker. He makes P.T. Barnum look like a piker. I'll tell you, he's good.
How does he get away with all of the crap during the campaign about lying Ted Cruz, and now he's going down there to campaign for him? What is this crap? How do you campaign for somebody you torched like that?
Well, don't forget, he also shifted the lion moniker over to Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Who, by the way, was his moment of comedic shtick, as it were, when he said, I have an idea. Let's nominate her to the Supreme Court and put her through the same kind of interrogation that they did to Brett Kavanaugh. And then, of course, his punchline was, we'll be here for 3 or 4 years.
Har, har, har.
Well, there you go. I mean, politics is a funny, funny thing. And speaking of politics, let's bounce over to New York City for a moment, because, you know, we've only had the kids in school for, what, a month now? And the new chancellor who came in from Houston, remember, he was de Blasio's pick after the school's chancellor from Miami shafted de Blasio at the 12th hour.
Yeah, turned him down.
This guy can't seem to get his game together because the buses, the school buses, are all having problems. And there are hundreds and thousands and thousands and hundreds and thousands of phone calls and angry letters and emails and tweets and texts saying, what the hell are you doing? And every time you turn around, this guy's fumbling for more bullshit to spew forth, just like his boss de Blasio, another guy who just can't do the job. Right. You have nothing but incompetence running the New York City government. In that respect, I'm very glad that I don't have kids, because I don't have to worry about where my kid might wind up on the school bus.
Right, and not only that, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, what we're learning more and more every day is that politics is about telling a lie and telling it as loudly as you possibly can, with no chance of the truth ever getting in the way. And it doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat, Donald Trump, or Bill de Blasio, it's the same game. Just lie. And keep it up, because as long as you keep it up and keep telling bigger lie after bigger lie, nobody will ever really catch on.
Right, and the fact that people in this city try to keep de Blasio, what's the word I'm looking for, in check. Unfortunately, it's really not working, you know, because he's got that kind of attitude and arrogance that says, I don't care, I'm the mayor.
Right.
And you reelected me for 4 more years, which... that's what they have to live with. I didn't vote for him the second time around, so I think that speaks volumes, you know?
Right.
But I digress, you know? Now let's talk about journalists getting chopped up into little pieces.
Oh, yeah, you see, in this
thing... I figured that... this is the kind of thing I figured you and I were prime targets for, with the shit that we said.
Yeah, right. Well, and this is the one thing that did manage to filter through with everything else that was going on last week while we were busy not paying attention to very much, other than friends and family, is this Khashoggi, I guess is how you say this guy's name, who wrote for the New York Times and then walked into the Saudi consulate in Turkey and never walked out alive. And now, I mean, here we are. It's been a little over a week since he disappeared. And in that week, we know what happened. And this is the galling part of all of this, is they left a trail. We know exactly what happened. We've got a really good idea who ordered it. And it's something that's very inconvenient for Donald Trump, which brings us right back to lie, obfuscate, cover up, and do it for every foreign dictator you possibly can while pissing on our allies.
Right. And the thing is, though, we all know that Saudi Arabia is not our friend.
Right.
You know? So... since Donald Trump likes to show his big brass balls, don't you think that would be a good place to actually put a smackdown?
But again, you can...
How many of those Saudis flew planes into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon?
Right, out of 19 of them, what was it, 14 of them were Saudi?
Yeah, I don't like those odds. Yeah, I mean, this guy walks into the consulate of all places, the one place you're supposed to be safest.
Yep.
Then again, it is Turkey, so... you know, that's just a country filled with crazies. I'm sorry.
That's nobody's business but the Turks. But yeah, exactly. And Trump has no idea what to do. So what does he do? He sends Jared Kushner over to fix it.
Oh, God. There's the guy to send to an Arab country.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Send Orthodox Jew. Great. Donald, take your head out of your ass for a minute. I know it's hard to do that, but try. You know? It's... something's got to give. I'm sorry. Something somewhere along the lines has got to give. It's just, I'm at a loss, a constant loss. I also want to step away from politics because it makes me angry. And I have enough to deal with on a daily basis in the real tangible world. I don't need this raising my blood pressure any further. You know, if you and I are going to get together for a nice kvetch session, people, that's a Yiddish word. Kvetch means to quell, you know, to complain, to bitch, moan, you know, gripe, which is what we old Jewish guys tend to do. We
right.
Kvetch.
But in the meantime, we do have our neighbors to the north. And by the way, I don't know if somebody left a window open up there, but it's starting to smell a lot like weed around these parts.
Man, oh, Manischewitz. You know, I'm telling you right now, we need to build a wall and it's got to be up that way.
You keep the stone Canadians. You know what, though? I mean, now that we can buy Canadian stocks, I think that somebody needs to figure out a way to invest heavily in Tim Hortons, because I'm thinking Tim Hortons, Taco Bell, anything like that across Canada right now is going to start booming like we've never seen a boom before.
You know, I would be game to invest in both, But being that we had something like 7 Taco Bells on Staten Island and we have none right now, I'm a little leery. A little leery, you know? But man, I do miss me a good old-fashioned bean and cheese burrito.
Yeah.
They were like, what, $1.25?
Right.
7-layer burrito is like 2 1/4.
Right, and the bean burrito would frequently go on sale for 79 cents. Yeah, I'll take 8 of those, thank you.
Every time I see a commercial for the chalupa box with the Baja Blast Mountain Dew, I get so sad because I want to try it, and I can't.
That should make you very sad. The fact that you actually want to try that crap.
Despite my wife, I want to try the Baja Blast, even though it does look like something that comes out of, you know, nuclear fallout.
Did you say despite your wife or despite your life?
No, despite my wife, because she's always bitching about it. She's like, what's wrong with you?
Well, like, you know,
I'm a man. That's what. I'm a man.
If you drink that crap, you may end up losing your life in the bargain. So I would be careful.
I am an American man. I am a real American. I fight for the rights of every man, and I want a Baja Blast.
Just proceed with caution. Meanwhile, there is a measure for medical marijuana here on the Missouri side of the river, and there's an interesting one on the Illinois side as well. So while Canada just said, yeah, whatever, man, toke up. Hereabouts, we're going about it a little bit, you know, fits and starts. And what's happening on the Illinois side is that the governor just signed a measure that would allow for medical marijuana to be prescribed to somebody who's trying to ditch opiates, which means that if you had an injury and got hooked on painkillers of one stripe or another, if you're taking too much Vicodin or Oxy or whatever, then you can switch to pot. And there, you know, the hope, obviously, is that you'll start smoking weed and leave the heavy pills alone. And you know what? If it works, great.
That's actually a wise idea. You know, certainly Staten Island, I think, has unfortunately gained yet another ugly reputation as being one of the havens for opioid deaths.
Yep.
And it's just a staggering number of people that you hear about dying on a weekly basis here. And nothing seems to work, you know. So if something like that can help ease the coming down or coming off of opiate addiction, so much the better. I would presume that it doesn't always have to be smoked marijuana, does it? I mean, there's that oil that here's the thing. Here in New York, a lot of people I know have started using this cannabis oil or hemp oil or whatever it is. If they suffer from anxiety, they put it in their coffee, you know, just like a couple of droplets from an eyedropper. And it seems to help ease the nerves.
Right.
And I don't have a problem with that.
Well, you can also not only get the edibles and you can get the oils and things like that, but they can do such a precise mix on that stuff because there's a couple of different compounds. One is called CBD, and that doesn't get you high at all, but it shows promise in pain alleviation and a couple of other things. And that's one of them that showed promise as an anti-seizure medication as well. And then there's THC, which is the stuff that gets you high. If they can keep the percentages in check and allow people who want a majority of one drug or the other, which it seems that they're able to do, then yeah, go ahead and do it. And the more research that we get this way, the better we'll be in trying to figure out what those percentages are supposed to be from somebody who suffers from any given disorder into the future.
Right. But this is, see, we're talking about it in a rational manner. We're talking about the positive use and then the necessary use to help people. You know, what this can do, not the whole, oh, let's go get high, man. No, no, no. There is a point and purpose to all of this.
Yes, there is. And it's one that, again, far too much time has passed for all of this stuff. But really what it amounts to is that the states that are forgetting all of this stuff, who are letting people get high if they want to, are the ones who aren't wasting their resources on something needless.
A very good point. Now, what about on the Missouri side of things?
Missouri is just wrestling with shall there be medical marijuana or not, and it looks like it's going to pass, which is an interesting thing considering that, again, this is the heart of the Midwest, and even in times where the rest of the country seems to be getting more, not liberal, but libertine about things, the Midwest tends to be a little bit more conservative and slow to the table. But Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, you know, Nebraska, for crying out loud, it's starting to look like at least the medical pot measures are either already passed or have a good chance at passing.
Interesting. Very interesting. I mean, right around the corner from my office opened a cafe that does, in fact, serve coffee with CBD in it.
There so, you go. Yeah.
CBD, right?
That's, yes, right.
So that's, yeah. And one of my dearest friends, when I was having coffee with her not too long ago, she did the same thing. She, you know, while we were at the cafe, and it was right here in Staten Island, she saw that they actually sold it there, and she said, you know what, I'm going to buy it, and I'm going to try it, because she has, you know, problems with anxiety and nerves and being, you know, unnecessarily tense, and it's a, I can understand it. I can understand it, because we come from the generation of people that took tranquilizers to deal with nerves.
Right. Yeah. And again, if you can stay off of that and use something that's a little bit more innocuous, then why not go ahead and do it?
Right. A very fair point. Now, speaking of idiocy ramping up, so apparently Republicans are mad at Taylor Swift for endorsing Democrats.
Oh, God. Yeah. This after how many years of rumors that Taylor Swift was actually some far right just this side of Goebbels, you know, that's why she never said anything about politics. And she comes out and endorses a bunch of Democrats and people have a heart attack. Going into this election, if there's anything that I give a shit about less than who Taylor Swift is going to vote for, I don't want to know what it is, or I want to have it shot.
Now, speaking of other idiots, let's talk about one of my favorite topics, you know, the far left.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we're not going to talk about you-know-who. We're going to talk about Pocahontas.
Elizabeth Warren. Uh-huh. Yeah. Boy, you talk about picking the wrong battle.
I'm going to use a phrase that you use very frequently because I think it is just so apt for this particular scenario and situation. She really managed to trip over her own dick.
Yes. Yes, she did. I, you know, that whole Pocahontas thing has been around now for a good few years. And, you know, Donald Trump wasn't the first one to use that to insult her. And the difference is, and what I don't understand about this most is the timing of it now, because, you know, that was all aimed her way while Donald Trump was running for president. Even if you were going to fight this battle over 1/64th of your heritage or whatever the hell it is, why would you wait 2 years?
Because she's an idiot and she likes to grab the limelight when she can. She's so self-absorbed and so out of touch with reality. She also really managed to fuck up, I think, the whole course of the way people were starting to view the campaigns in general. Because, you know, they want people to not be lunatics. They're, you know, even what's his name, he who will not be mentioned.
Right.
You know, they're kind of starting to start to say in a roundabout way, maybe you really shouldn't run in 2020. Maybe you need to just back up and stay where you are in the Senate and just do what you've been doing and don't, because we can't afford to have 4 more years of Donald Trump. And if you get involved in the mix, he's going to win for certain, you know. But she's got this brash approach to everything. She has that patronizing schoolmarm way about her that really she's just condescending to everyone right across the board. And I have to admit, I love seeing her being made a complete fool of, because she did it to herself. That's comeuppance, and I love comeuppance.
Right. So, yeah, and I mean, she's tried to play a very difficult political game for the last few years, and it's not doing her any favors. She's not holding up well. And what she obviously wants to do eventually is to try to mount some kind of credible presidential run. She's got the Senate run to worry about first, but she wants to eventually at least try it and try a real run at the presidency. And if this is how she's faring this early in the game, she may as well just not even.
Well, I'll tell you what, I would really hope that they flush out all the clowns and charlatans right across the board when their times come. When her time comes, I wish to God McConnell would be beaten soundly, because I loathe him probably more than, and I hate him more than I hate Donald Trump.
Right.
But again, I have just cause to hate Donald Trump. You know, everybody else is like, oh, I hate Trump. No. You haven't lived in New York. You don't live in New York. Shut up. We take precedent over you. I take precedent over you because we've had to deal with that inflamed boil on the asshole of this city for 40 years now.
Right.
You know? But I, you know, this, the more people keep getting all up in arms about the upcoming elections, I'm telling you right now, it's not going to go the way they want it to. It really isn't. And it's starting to shape up because the numbers are starting to come in a lot tighter now and a lot clearer, and numbers are starting to flip in ways that the Democrats are panicking.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of their candidates are just not sound choices. They're not. They're not a party of rationality. They're not a party of seriousness and focus. It's all one special interest group and another special interest group and factions. That's it. There's no coherent theme throughout the Democratic Party besides Donald Trump bad.
Right. Well, and you're exactly right about that. There is no message, and we've talked about that before, the fact that there is no cohesive. You can't look at anybody individually, or you can't look at the choices for the House of Representatives and the Senate alone, or as a group, and look at them and say, I know what it is that they stand for. I know what it is that they want, because nobody's saying it. And on top of that, you know, you have another issue that's going on right now with governor's races across the country, because that's the one place where if you want to look at the last 20 years and say, why do the Republicans keep losing popular vote in the presidential elections and winning the presidency? And why is it that the Senate and the House candidates, especially the House candidates on the Republican side, are so firmly entrenched? It's because Democrats forgot to run for governor in a lot of places, and the gerrymandering and all the other shit that goes on, it's governors that control that. So yeah, you know, there's a reason why in states that are governed by Republicans, you have a majority in the House, because they're able to draw the districts. So maybe the Democrats, if they really want to win something or have something that's worth holding on to for another 20 years, they ought to start running decent candidates for governorships. Now, the one that's going on here in Illinois between Bruce Rauner and J.B. Pritzker looks like it's going to be a Republican leaving for a Democrat coming in. But Rauner was the first Republican governor in anybody's memory in Illinois. So it really isn't so much a gain as it is a win back. And, you know, I guess it's something for the Democrats, but still, there's going to have to be a whole lot more than that, where they're able to flip states and say, you know what, we've got Democratic governors in a majority of states, especially the populous ones, then people will start paying attention.
It's going to be an interesting couple of weeks, that's for sure. Because we're now, two weeks away till the election?
Right.
Yeah, so you and I have to go out there on the trail and start following around some of these campaigns and, you know, reporting from the field.
Yep.
Because we're intrepid reporters.
Oh, you know, and as a New Yorker, this has got to have special meaning for you, even though I don't think they ever officially said that Sesame Street was in New York City. You look around, it's New York City.
Oh, come on. That's Pigsty.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So,
or in this case, Pigsty.
And so we had somebody retire from Sesame Street after a very, very long career. I think 50 years with that troupe.
Harold Spinney
played
Bird, and we're not referring to de Blasio, Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch from the day the show went on the air in 1969.
Yes. So, yeah, going on 50 years.
The only Big Bird and the only Oscar the Grouch, which is an amazing accomplishment, especially when you think about all the episodes that aired when it was actually on PBS. I hate to say it, and granted, I may have watched it the first year that it was actually on, maybe the first 2 years maximum, because I was 4 and 5 years old, and by that time I just wasn't interested in, you know, birds and learning how to count, because I already knew how to count and spell. You know, I was more interested in watching things like The Partridge Family,
right?
And, you know, singing I Think I Love You to the little blonde-haired girl from around the corner from me. You know, you have one person playing two characters for such a long time, but never being known as the person who did it unless you read the credits.
Right.
You know, at least, you know, if you were somebody who watched Sesame Street, I don't care how old you are, it's probably still ingrained with you. You know who the characters were to this day. And I'm talking about the human characters, not the puppet characters. And so, you know, the last one to retire, if I'm not mistaken, is Bob McGrath, who was, you know, the kind of the wise voice of reason on the show. That's how I always like to look at him. He was the one who always explained things to kids.
Right.
You know? And he did it in a way that was never, you know, pandering or talking down, which is a very rare thing to do when it comes to a show for children.
Sure.
Especially preschoolers and, you know, children of the kindergarten age.
It was Bob, and I remember this because I was still fairly young when it happened, young enough to really care about it. It was Bob who explained to a group of the smaller Muppets what happened when Mr. Hooper died.
Hooper died, yep. Even I watched that because I wanted to see how they were going to handle it.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, he was trying to explain it to Big Bird and Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the only time you ever saw Oscar cry. It's very powerful. But the thing is that Carol Spinney is the last original member of the cast.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a sad statement because Sesame Street got shoved off onto HBO. And you can only find it at fragmented times. So, you know, like so many other parts of certainly our childhood, for all intents and purposes, you know, it's a bittersweet thing, but I hope he'll enjoy, you know, the fact that now he doesn't have to worry about, he doesn't have to work, you know, he's done an incredible job for 50 years, basically.
Right. Right. And that's the thing, is it was never anything less than that. And that can't be easy. I mean, that can't be easy on the body, much less, you know, the voice and trying to do three things at once. It really was. It's an incredible talent.
Absolutely agreed. So, you know, and again, for all the cynicism that I hold towards, you know, kids shows, because by the time kids shows really started to take off, like Zoom and the Electric Company and all that, I was too old for it.
Yeah.
So I didn't watch it. You know, but the first 2 years of Sesame Street, you know, had my time because it was, you know, kindergarten, preschool and kindergarten, you know, and that was it. By first grade, I don't, you know, what was I watching? Mannix? I don't know.
Mannix. Oh, Jake and the Fat Man, I think, is what we all graduated to. But that's
like later on. That's after, you know, William Conrad had played Cannon, for Christ's sake.
That's right. Oh, but too much.
I'm the generation of the Quinn Martin production.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, if they don't have Clue Gulliger, it's just wrong.
Oh, no kidding. Or at that time, Leslie Nielsen was everybody's go-to bad guy.
Right, right. And you know what? There was even one where it was the other one from Airplane. It was Peter Graves, who was playing, I think, the evil president in a movie called Parts, the Clonus Horror, which was one of those. Yeah, just really, really awful. but, you know, yeah, you got to have something. And they certainly did for a long time, but still, yeah, it is. Whenever something happens on Sesame Street that's related to that show, it will always go back right to the heart of my childhood. And that time when you first became aware of a world that was, you know, it was a fantasy world, but it was a place that made sense to you. It was a place that felt safe. You learned what play acting was through watching people like the guys on Sesame Street do it.
What I also liked about those original days of Sesame Street was the fact that they did a lot of non sequiturs. You know, like when they would all of a sudden start that weird psychedelic countdown.
Yeah, right.
That prog rock, you know, middle where, you know, all the numbers would start coming in, and somebody, I forgot who it was. It's somebody who's actually really well known was doing the vocals, like singing in that off key voice.
Right, and then they had the kids do the count up and then the countdown, the 10. Nine. Right. You know, it was great.
Little spy guys with their coats opening up with the numbers and all that. Yeah. You know, they get to seven and they always have the chef with the big cake and he'd always wind up falling down the stairs with the cake. You know, well, for God's sakes, that's where I got my introduction to Kermit the Frog here.
Yep.
Because Kermit was a regular part of it. I think the count was part of the original Sesame Street. I think Big Bird, Oscar,
Grover.
That's right. Cookie Monster.
Yep. And Sweetums. Sweetums came along later because he was one of the few that transitioned outside of Kermit, that transitioned from Sesame Street to the Muppet Show. He was the big tall one that was always dressed in rags and had a big giant nose.
Yeah, see, he was definitely later on. That's definitely later on. And I remember the people on the show. There was Gordon and Susan,
yep.
Bob and Mr. Hooper, and that was it. And then, you know, various kids that were there.
And Gordon and Susan ended up getting married, right?
I think so.
I think they were really married, and they got married on the show.
The original Gordon, not the bald one.
Right, right.
The one who kind of looked like, what's his name? Walt Frazier.
Right, exactly, yes. Oh, man. But yeah, fun times. Oh, and it was Luis. That's right. It wasn't Gordon. It was Luis who married, what's her name?
Well, Luis wasn't on the show when I was watching it.
Okay, yeah, he did. He came along later.
And plus there was, I think they had two different women playing Susan.
Yep.
So that was another little tidbit of Sesame Street, what do you call it? Nostalgia for you.
And we never noticed. Now, into the music realm we delve. And again, a sad goodbye. Although, I mean, he's still alive. Now Carol Spinney just gets to go off and enjoy retirement. Well-deserved as it was once again. But as we look into the music world, I know there's something that you've been sitting on for a couple of weeks now that goes back to a couple of very talented singer-songwriters. And
one of whom is not here anymore.
Yeah, one of whom, yeah, sadly left us just a few years back in Glenn Frey. But explain Long Branch Penny Whistle and where this stuff has been now for all these years.
Okay. Long Branch Penny Whistle was the first group, even though it was really a duo, that Glenn Frey formed when he got out to California from Detroit. Oddly enough, he formed this group with John David Souther, J.D. Souther, who's also a Detroit native. Oddly enough, which I did not know. And they formed this group when they met in California. They started this kind of funky little duo and were signed to a small label called Amos Records, which was distributed by Bell. They put out a self-titled album in 1969, and it came and went without a trace, and they called it quits as an act about a year or so later. That didn't mean that they still weren't roommates and the best of friends, because they were. And while they were still sharing an apartment with their upstairs neighbor, Jackson Browne, we all know what happened to all three of their careers.
Right.
Nevertheless, this album disappeared and became just like a little asterisk and footnote in Glenn Frey's career, illustrious career with the Eagles. Now, I first heard these songs in the History of the Eagles documentary, and I just thought, well, these are kind of cool. And I started to see if I could find a copy of it somewhere, and it's kind of hard to come by because it wasn't that many, you know, copies available. It wasn't that widely distributed. And I want to make this little side note. Amos Records also had on the label a band from Texas called Shiloh, who were found, brought to the label, and produced by Kenny Rogers. Okay. The drummer of this band, Shiloh, was a guy named Don Henley.
I've heard of him.
What were the odds that both Henley and Frey were in two separate groups on the same label as label mates? And they wound up meeting at the Troubadour when they wound up joining Linda Ronstadt's backing band. That's where the formation of the Eagles really takes off. But in the meantime, this album of Long Branch Penny Whistle just was this, like I said, an asterisk in Glenn Frey's career. Earlier this year, Geffen Records put out an anthology box set of Glenn Frey's work, and they actually pulled the Long Branch Penny Whistle tracks onto it. Now they've actually released it as a separate entity. So they've re-released it on vinyl, and it's been given its first time release on CD, and I want to give them props for actually doing the print of the old label itself in the same typeface, except it doesn't have the Amos logo. It has the Geffen logo. But it sounds absolutely terrific. And what this is just some really good old-fashioned, down-home, pure country rock boogie. The kind of things that I can only equate with one other band at that time, and that would be Michael Nesmith's First National Band.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's got that kind of feel and vibe to it. The songs are really great. Obviously, they're young, they're hungry, they're horny, they're high, and it's exactly what you want going into this. I mean, my favorite song is a track on there, which is of Glenn Frey's, called Run, Boy, Run. And it's just, you know, good old-fashioned, her daddy's gonna kill me kind of song.
Well, an easy-going rock and roll refugee booked trouble on a southbound train. The law books say that I'm a guilty man, and I wouldn't get time to explain. Dead run, ain't no stopping till I make the borderline. Two more miles on a bottomland run till I find a sanctuary in the Georgia pine. Hey, run, boy, run. You gotta move. Run, boy.
And it's just a terrific album, but then J.D. Souther comes in with a couple of real stellar moments. Probably Mr. Mister is the one. Nope, no kidding. I as much as I hated that band and their name, it's a very powerful song, and you got to think about it in context of the divide between an older person of the establishment looking down on a young man and thinking you know what he's thinking and feeling when you don't. And vice versa. A song about misperceptions.
No locks on the doors. And love. And more love.
Very cool.
You know, most of the lion's share of the songs are written by J.D. Souther, and he's in fine voice. At points they sound interchangeable. You can't really tell who's singing, but this is one of those, my God, where has this record been kind of moments. It makes you want to seek it out, and there are no bum tracks on here. It's a great piece from a very specific time, and the fact that it is who it is makes it all the sweeter. So I'm very happy that Long Branch Penny Whistle is back and available for all to hear.
Good.
And discover.
Yeah, and in a format that we can all appreciate. So excellent work there. So Long Branch Penny Whistle, one to definitely put on the list. And there's a couple of other things to get to before we get to In Our Heads. And we've been tracking this for the last few weeks, getting more and more into who's coming and going in terms of toy shops and these names from the past, these legendary names of places where we used to go and shop. So many of them have fallen away, and JCPenney's been in trouble now for the last 30 years, but so is Sears, and Sears made a big move this week. They finally went ahead and filed.
Yeah, and we don't know. I know that the Memphis Sears is closing. I don't believe the Staten Island one is yet, but the full list has not been published as far as I know of what stores will in fact be closed. They say something along the lines of they're starting a gear now. Good luck.
Yeah.
But now towards Sears.com and Kmart.com. I don't know. I don't see it. I just really don't see it.
They're too late to the party. And even with a name like Sears right now, having that name, unfortunately, I think is going to hurt them more than it's going to help them, because yeah, it's a legendary name to you and me. Our kids don't know Sears. They know Amazon.
Exactly. They don't know the joy of the wish book.
Yeah, right. Or the underwear section. And
for those of us who were husky when we were younger, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know that they're going to be able to compete in that world, because I don't think they know what it means. If they knew what it meant, they would have made a move like this 20 years ago.
Absolutely correct. Now, a couple of other things we do need to touch on, because it is of the time. One, HBO has in fact renewed The Deuce, which has not gotten any better, for one final season. So obviously they're going to probably jump into, it's 1978 now. I'm projecting that it will probably start in 1981, around the beginning of the AIDS crisis, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's what's coming next. Because right now they're talking about, you know, their arc is about the women who had been on the street and prostitutes in the first season are all now acting in porn.
Okay.
So I foresee that's where it's going to go, because they lost the plot, and I'm not being facetious. It's sad. It was a great first run. Like I said, that last season was interesting and riveting and well done. This season, the exact opposite. So that's that. We have a World Series. It's the Boston Red Sox against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Please, Boston, beat them senseless. Hurt them. Hurt them. Make them yield. Manny Machado, wow. I really hope that he does not get anything close to what he thinks he's going to get for a free agency contract once the series is over. He's just, apart from the fact that he showed himself to be something of a dirty player, I found myself, as many people were, shocked by comments that he made last week about how he admits, "I'm really not a hustle kind of player. Don't expect it out of me."
No shit.
Yeah, seriously. He said that last week because he was being taken to task for his not great performances in the playoffs against Milwaukee, you know? And the fact that Milwaukee ran it to 7 games and couldn't get the job done in the 7th game is a real shame, because that's a team of hungry players who grind it out.
Yeah.
Dodgers just got lucky in Game 7. But let's not forget, they got beaten by the Astros last year in the World Series. They're looking at a much nastier team in the Red Sox. Don't forget, the Red Sox had 109 wins this season.
Right, and who did they beat to get there again?
Yeah, Houston. They had to go through, and the Astros put up fight, but Boston is just that much stronger.
Yep.
Period. So we will hope, we will pray. New York Rangers, they suck. End of story. Got nothing else to say about them. Lundqvist, he's got to go.
Yeah. Buffalo Sabres, unfortunately, same deal. And with the Bills, yeah, who would have thought that it was a bad idea to go into the season with only 2 quarterbacks, one of whom you know sucks, and the other one is a rookie?
The Jets lost to the team that is now proclaimed as the laziest football team out there, the Vikings.
Right. Well, the Bills barely escaped being blanked by Houston, and Houston was one of the few teams with a worse record than the Bills, and still we managed to lay an egg in this one. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, until Allen comes back, there's going to be nothing, absolutely nothing that's going to come out of that team that's any good. And even after he gets back, they're still a very, very young team with a rookie quarterback who got hurt halfway through his first season.
Well, 2 things. One, did the Titans ever win a game this season or no?
Yeah, Tennessee has won at least one.
Okay. So nobody's got no wins.
I don't think so.
Okay. We know Cleveland won because they won against the Jets.
Right. And they barely escaped their second tie on the year. Because remember, Cleveland was in a tie game earlier, and they lost to Tampa this week, but Tampa missed a field goal late in the going in overtime that would have won the game for them, and they had to come back and do it again. So... yeah,
the thing is, the Sabres, they have excuses. They have a young goaltender.
Right.
We're stuck with Henrik Lundqvist. End of story. At least the Sabres have an excuse.
Yep.
Huh? Okay, so having said all that, I think we are ready to roll with in our heads.
Yeah, and I just checked it out, by the way. Yeah, there are several 1-5 teams, the Raiders being one of them. But yeah, everybody's got at least one so far this year.
Got it. Okay. So, good to know.
Yeah. And In Our Heads is actually going to be the first of a 2-parter this week, because when next we make our way to the interwebs, it will either be Halloween or just the day after. So I figure we'll stay in that vein for this time around, even though we'll be about a week out from the big day. I do so much love Halloween, and it brings to mind, of course, an entire day spent doing nothing but binge watching scary movies. And you know, we talk so little about something that's such a giant part of making a movie, setting the scene, setting the tension level, especially in a horror movie, and that's the music that goes behind it. And there are a couple of legendary ones when it comes to scary movie soundtracks. I mean, The Exorcist is certainly right up there. Halloween is right up there. You know, it's tough to really outstrip those two, but you start digging down into some of the other horror and you find even the Friday the 13th, even though it's not really a song, it's such a readily identifiable that thing. You know, you're watching a Friday the 13th movie and it's scary as hell. So let's explore this a little bit and talk about those movies in addition to, you know, things like the shower scene in Psycho that were able to become legends, not just because they were scary, but because the music was awesome.
Well, that I was about to say, you know, the theme music for Psycho is always so memorable, that, you know, that opening thing with the violin. Kind of veer posters all over the place. In fact, I remember Busta Rhymes sampled it for Give Me Some More, which I thought was one of the most brilliant things I'd ever heard in my life. You know, that was just sheer genius. First start, let's talk about some of the movies in general, because you're saying that you would binge watch them.
Definitely.
I would just be binging on the candy that I may have, you know, absconded with. Instead of saying, all I got was a rock. But, you know, for me, it was never so much a case of being scared by these movies, but to be creeped out.
Right.
That's where the greater effect takes place. You know, I still can watch something like, you know, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, the original,
yeah,
and the original Blob, and just being icked out by it.
Steve McQueen, man. You got to love Steve McQueen in The Blob.
Greatest moment of all of them. Cold. We need something cold. Oh, the acting. And, of course, you know, The Thing with Two Heads.
Yes. With you Ray Milland and Rosie Grier.
No. What's the other one? The one with Bruce Dern, where he and Casey Kasem and Pat Priest, where they take the retard and the inbred hillbilly, and they put the inbred hillbilly killer's head.
You're not thinking of Reanimator, are you?
No. It's almost identical to The Thing with Two Heads.
Wow, I don't know.
You've never seen it? Oh, it's a classic. It's an absolute classic. In fact, you talk for a moment about some of these movies because you've got some great, you know, great stuff anyway. And I'm going to look this up because I'll have it for you.
Good. And that'll give me the chance to wax poetic about John Carpenter, because John Carpenter, I think of not only for his directorial prowess, and he's done some incredible stuff, but, you know, between Carpenter and Landis, you have some great music involved in some of these things as well. And Carpenter scored a lot of his own movies. He scored Christine. And, you know, it was funny because that was in that keyboard driven, I think Christine came out in 1983 or 84. And, you know, the pop music at the time was very keyboard driven. So you got a soundtrack that was like that as well, even though it didn't really fit with a car from 1958. Music that they chose, the old-timey, old rock and roll stuff that they put into that movie, songs like Keep a Knockin' and I Wonder Why by Dion and the Belmonts.
No, I love you like I do. No, I do.
Served as that sort of juxtaposition that you and I talk about all the time with songs, where you had a creepy movie, and yet to sort of lighten the tension, they drop in these doo-wop numbers from 1958. I just thought it was extremely well done. And padding it out with the Harlem Nocturne during the scene where Christine is rebuilding herself in Darnell's garage, just fantastic. And another one that goes into that same camp is American Werewolf in London. Not only an absolute incredible movie, starring, by the way, among others, Frank Oz from The Muppets, who was in that movie briefly, but the soundtrack that's in that, a lot of strings, a lot of classic, and you could tell it really drew from some of the Hitchcock movies, including Psycho. Tension is built using an orchestrated sound. And then, of course, all the special effects, all the Rick Baker genius that was all splashed all over that movie is just incredible. And so, yeah, between those two, that kind of defined early 80s horror for me. And again, it had a lot to do with the music and what was going on the screen.
Now, you know, you brought up the fact that Hitchcock always had those wonderful orchestrations in whatever scenes or climactic scenes.
Yes.
And that, it's not a horror movie, but it's a thriller. And I'm thinking about North by Northwest.
Yep.
That scene when Cary Grant is running through the field, you know, being chased by the plane, which is one of the greatest shots, you know, cinematically speaking, of all time.
Yep.
But, you know, it's the drama of the orchestra. But I'll go a really classic, creepy soundtrack, The Third Man.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I mean, as it is, Orson Welles was creepy.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that's a given. But every time, you know, you heard that particular use of the theremin, you're going to tell me you didn't get the icks from that? Yeah.
Well, and you can take that a step further as well and go right from The Third Man into a movie that kind of crossed a bunch of different boundaries from, well, being based on a Shakespeare play to science fiction, horror, suspense, everything. I mean, Forbidden Planet. Fantastic movie, and the theremin use in that, all kinds of weird. But it kind of had to be, because, you know, here they are on this random planet out in the middle of nowhere. So things had to sound a little creepy and off-kilter.
Okay, you ready? The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. It's from 1971.
And Bruce Dern is in this?
Bruce Dern is the star of it. It's the earlier companion to the 1972, and they're calling it a blaxploitation film, yep. The Thing with Two Heads.
Right, with Rosie Grier and Ray Milland.
Right. But this is Bruce Dern, Pat Priest as his poor wife, and Casey Kasem as his friend and conscience. You know? Because, you know, he's another doctor, and he's like, what you're doing is wrong, damn it, man. You know, you can't do this kind of an abomination. But, yep, I saw that, and that movie freaked me out more than The Thing with Two Heads. This is just downright psychotic and bizarro.
Okay, so let's get into that, and we'll end on this note, and we'll talk some more about the music and everything and get some more Halloween stuff going for In Our Heads next week on part two of this conversation. But the movies that, whether they fit neatly into the horror movie basket or not, the ones that you walked out of the theater going, oh man, it's going to take some time to recover from that. And here I'm thinking...
Carrie.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But I was 11.
You were 11 years old when Carrie came. I was thinking specifically about Eraserhead.
Interesting.
Something about Eraserhead. That movie freaks me out something rotten. That one, and there was another movie that, there were three of them that had kind of the same sounding titles. There was Pumpkinhead, which starred the guy who played Bishop.
Lance Henriksen, right.
Yeah, the one who played Bishop in Aliens, which is another killer movie. So that was Pumpkinhead. Then you had Rawhead Rex, which I think predated Pumpkinhead by about 10 years. And then there was Eraserhead, and Eraserhead was just bizarre.
I never thought of that. Actually, you know what? When you get right down to it, the scariest movie I think I've ever seen and had to sit through and live through it and afterwards said it's going to take a while to recover, Titanic.
Yeah, I think mine was Beaches.
I don't know which is worse. I mean, did you have to sit in a theater to see that shit?
Yeah. I was married.
Apart from a numb ass sitting there for 3.5 hours watching this shit. Uh-huh. Unless Evita sucked. That was even more of a horror show.
Oh, I know. But yeah, I am glad you're in that camp, because I actively hate the movie Titanic with a burning passion.
There's only two good things about that movie. Kate Winslet's breasts and he dies. He drowns.
Right.
Good. That's it.
Yeah.
Nothing more. Titanic is the biggest fucking nuisance of a movie I've ever seen. But I sat, you know, the exact words were, oh, it's going to take a while to recover from that. Sorry. Now, if you're talking about creeped out or freaked out or weirded out, or Carrie was one, but I was 11. So you have to, you know, make some allowances there.
Yeah.
I was kind of weirded out by Scanners.
Scanners would do it.
You know, that was another one. And, I wasn't so much freaked out, but just a little weirded out in a kind of funny way. What's the movie with Pinhead? Is that Hellraiser?
Hellraiser, yeah. And then Hellbound Hellraiser Part 2, and then they made a zillion sequels after that. That's all Clive Barker.
Yeah, I mean, that the first one with Pinhead was just, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, well, the second one's even better. In terms of just movie making, you know, movie craft, yeah, Hellbound Hellraiser Part 2 is just fantastic. And there's a scene in that movie where a woman is in the middle of reconstituting from being a corpse back into being a living, breathing, human-ish kind of thing. And she's about 70% there, so she doesn't have any skin on, and it's all muscles and, you know, oozing blood and all of this stuff. And she dances with a guy. And it's, I want to tell you, it is one of the sickest scenes ever, and yet it's one of those that you can't stop watching once you get into it.
See, they don't make movies like that anymore.
I'm telling you, and they need to start again. But yeah, I don't know. There's so many of them. There's so many creepy movies that I've seen over the years. And I'll tell you, another one that has no blood whatsoever in it and almost no story, which sounds like a slam, but it really isn't, is a movie from, I think it was 1965 or 1966, called Carnival of Souls. And
what was that movie?
Oh, actually, it's inexplicable, and it's fantastic. I don't know. I still am not entirely sure what's happening in that movie, but it's shot in such a fantastic fashion that if you've never seen Carnival of Souls, go see it. Go seek it out.
Oh, and one more. I mean, the ultimate classic in just creepy movies that make you feel, you almost feel like you need a shower afterwards. Freaks.
Yes.
When we were kids, we didn't have cable.
Right.
We would see these movies, certainly the classic ones that we're talking about, by watching, you know, Channel 5 and Channel 11 and Channel 9, you know. Channel 9 always had, you know, like, you know, The Thing from Outer Space, or The Thing that came and wouldn't leave, you know. Or, it was always a Thing movie, you know.
Yeah, Thing That Wouldn't Die. The Thing from Beyond Space, which was just shortened to The Thing.
And
that
of course,
the James Arness one.
And then Plan 9 from Outer Space, we've seen on that. That was the only one that ever got any play on regular television here. The only one of the Ed Wood flicks. Oh, those great genius films.
Glenn or Glenda. Oh, man. Yeah, but yeah, at least he was out there trying. But there's so much more to cover. Oh, and another one that kind of goes into that Carnival of Souls camp. I think we may have talked about this one before. It was the second cinematic telling. Actually, no, it may have been the first of I Am Legend, which was eventually covered in the 70s as Omega Man. Right. But there was a Vincent Price version from 1958 or 59 called The Last Man on Earth, and it's fantastic.
The one great Vincent Price movie that I'll never forget is Master of the World, with a very young Charles Bronson. And it's this weird dirigible in the 1800s, but it was just such a, it was a heavy duty movie. And we saw it in the after school center, you know, because we used to have that in the public schools. We'd have, you know, it was on Wednesdays. Every Wednesday they would have, you know, you play kickball or wiffle ball or whatever, or air hockey, you know, just after school stuff to do. And sometimes they show movies, and they got movies like this, and we were like, yeah, let's watch this. And now I'm getting all nostalgic. I hate that.
Well, yeah, but the great thing about The Last Man on Earth is that here you had Vincent Price, one of the greatest creepy actors of all time, and he's the sympathetic character in this one. He's not the bad guy. He's the guy who's, you know, he's playing the part that was later on played by Charlton Heston and then Will Smith. So,
Prince, I don't give Will Smith any credit for anything. He's not all that or a bag of chips.
I never even saw it. I know that he made the movie I Am Legend, and I heard terrible things about it, and that kind of went along with what I figured it was going to be anyway, so I didn't bother.
Look at it this way. Parents just don't understand.
All right, man. Well, that's going to do it for this week. And again, more horror movie and horror movie music for you on the In Our Heads thing next week. If you can think of more, put them in the comment section. We love seeing that stuff. So,
of course we do. Please.
Add in. Do that. And Rob Ross, you do that. And I will see you in a week.
Yes, indeed, my friend. Be well, stay well, and to all our listeners, if we do this after Halloween, have a happy and safe Halloween, and don't eat too much candy. We'll see you very soon.